And then what?
And then we die, I suppose.
She stared into his impassive face. When I met him, Alberta thought, I was ready for death. I thought my life was over, that I'd outlived my purpose. Now I don't want to die. This man, this half-machine, has given me a reason for living. He reached out with his human hand and touched her arm.
It's all right. I'll escort you back to Ceres. The rock rats are almost finished building their new habitat.
Chrysalis, too,
Alberta murmured. Yes, said Dorn. You'll be safe there, and you can find passage back to Earth or Selene without me.
You'll return here, she said.
He gave no answer. None was required. She knew his need. Abruptly, Alverda turned in the command chair and began to peck at the communications console.
What are you doing? Dorn asked.
I'm calling the news media. There's a woman in Selene, Douglas Stavanger's wife. She's a famous news anchor.
No, said Dorn.
Why not? Once the world knows what we're trying to accomplish, not even Martin Humphreys would dare to harm us.
You'd tell them you're with Doric Harbin, the monster?
I'll tell them I'm with Dorn, the priest, the man who has dedicated his life to recovering the bodies of those killed in the wars.
Humphreys knows who I am, said Dorn.
He has whole battalions of public relations experts. Your story will be swamped by his. Vigilantes will come out here to find me. The hunt will become a news event. Our deaths will be called executions.
She took her hand away from the keyboard.
You want to die, don't you?
I deserve to die, he said.
I need a ship, said Victor Zacharias. Big George Ambrose leaned back in his swivel chair and nodded resignedly.
You've been telling me that for nearly 3 fucking years now.
The two men were sitting in Big George's office in the half-finished Chrysalis II habitat. It was hardly an imposing room, no larger than most of the office spaces aboard the habitat. George's massive desk and intimidating figure made it seem even smaller. The walls were blank at the moment. Smart screens that could display anything in the habitat's computer files, or show views of the outside, where teams of engineers and robots were working to complete the structure. Victor's jet-black ringlets were neatly trimmed, but in the 3 years of his enforced stay at Ceres, he had grown a thickly curled beard. He wore the maroon coveralls that identified him as a member of the habitat's technical staff. Big George still looked like a shaggy mountain man with his untamed mane of brick-red hair and wild beard. His coveralls were light blue, rumpled, frayed at the cuffs from long wear. With the icy calmness of a man who was trying hard to control his anger, Victor said, "My family is out there somewhere, and I've got to find them." George shook his bushy head.
"Look, Vic, you've got to face facts. They're dead by now."
"No," Victor insisted. "The ship had plenty of provisions, and
why haven't we heard from them, then, in all this time? It's been more than 3 years, hasn't it?"
Victor glared at his boss. With that dark beard, he would have looked fiercely intimidating to anyone else. But George Ambrose knew better. By the time the task of finding all the bodies from the massacre of the original Chrysalis was finished, Big George had learned that Victor Zacharias had been an architect, a builder. As head of the Rock Rats Governing Council, George had persuaded the International Astronautical Authority to fund the building of a new habitat in orbit around Ceres. The IAA got support for the project from Selene and the major corporations involved in space industries. The new habitat, Chrysalis II, would not be a ramshackle tinker toy assemblage of old and disused spacecraft. George Ambrose wanted a structure that was designed and constructed specifically to be a home for the Rock Rats, and he wanted Victor Zacharias to head the team that built it. Victor reluctantly agreed to do the job, but only if Big George would provide him with a ship afterward.
Face it, Vic,
George said from behind his desk.
They're gone.
You promised me a ship, Victor said again, relentless.
When the job's done, it's only half finished.
The design is complete, Victor insisted. The major structural work is finished. You don't need me for the rest of it. A couple of trained chimpanzees could finish the job.
Nearest trained chimps are Earthside, Vic. But you're here, and you're going to stay here until the fucking job's finished. And that's it.
George slapped his heavy hands on the desktop and rose to his feet, an imposing red-bearded giant of a man who would brook no further discussion. Victor got out of his chair, his eyes smoldering, but he said nothing further. He knew that this conversation was finished. Silently, he walked to the door.
By the way, Big George called to him, Pleiades is due in later today. China Madagascar'll be looking you up.
Over his shoulder, Victor grumbled, Thanks for the good news. Attack Ship Viking, Captain's Quarters. It's good to be the captain, Cao Yuan thought as he lay stretched out in his double-sized bunk. His communications officer, the lissom young brunette with slow eyes and surprising athletic abilities, was in his shower stall, singing to herself. Off-key, Yuan realized. But what the hell? She's got other talents. Tamara, he pronounced silently, rolling her name around in his mind. Tamara Vyshinsky. In bed, she had told Yuan that she'd studied for ballet as a child. The training serves her well, he thought. HSS headquarters had added her to his crew at the last moment, flying her all the way out from the moon to reach Viking before Yuan started his hunt for the renegade. She came with high qualifications in communication systems, and in sexual gymnastics, Yuan thought, grinning inwardly. He badly wanted to turn over and sleep for another hour. I deserve the rest, he told himself. But Viking and its accompanying two ships were fast approaching the area where the sensor had reported Doric Harbin's vessel to be. We could be in battle today, he knew. Reluctantly, Yuan rolled out of bed and padded to the steamy shower stall. Opening the door, he said sternly, This is your captain speaking. Now hear this. The comm officer reached out with both arms and pulled him into the hot, sudsy stall. He slid his arms around her and pressed close. We've got plenty of time, he thought. Plenty of time.
Elverda paced the short passageway between Hunter's Bridge and the hatch that led into the main airlock. Despite all the rejuvenation therapies, you are still an old, old woman, she reminded herself. You must exercise your legs. After a lifetime in low-gravity environments, the ship's acceleration was punishing her, even though Dorn kept it well below 1G. He was up in the bridge, sitting in the command chair as impassively as a sculpture of steel. Is he fleeing from the assassins coming after us? Elverda wondered. Or rushing to find the bodies of the slain? Some of both, she concluded. We seldom do anything for merely one reason. And you? She asked herself. What are you fleeing from? What are you rushing to? Death, she answered. The answer to both questions is the same. Her creative career had been finished many long years ago, decades ago. She was going through the motions of teaching at Selene University when Martin Humphreys swept her out to the asteroid belt, agog to see the artifact that a rock rat family had accidentally discovered. It has to be the work of alien intelligence, Elverda told herself. No human could have made it. Yet, it related to humans in a way that stirred the soul, viscerally, beyond the five senses. The artwork, for Elverda was convinced it was a work of superhuman artistry, bored directly into one's mind, into the depths of the unconscious intellect that lay hidden and disguised beneath the conscious personality.